This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In almost every one of the ISIS videos in which John Cantley appears, he identifies himself like this.
Hello there. I'm John Cantley, the British citizen abandoned by my government.
And in one of those videos, in between explaining the triumphs of the Islamic State and the warped Western media, he speaks for a moment with eerie conviction.
We were left to die. It's the worst feeling in the world, being left behind like that. We'd been in the longest, paid our dues, watched everyone else go home, never stopped believing, and then wham! Have some of that. You're not worth negotiating for. To be left behind so cynically by the country you thought you knew was some kind of ultimate betrayal.
Those words, whether his true belief or not, can't but electrify the long-standing debate about how to get hostages home, a debate that's escalated in the last few years with the rise of ISIS and the spate of kidnappings, back-channel releases, and brutal public murders.
American journalist Stephen Sotloff of Time magazine, held by ISIS, reportedly has been beheaded in Syria.
The video that was posted Saturday night showed the killing of David Haines and showed a threat to kill another British hostage.
The terror group has released this video showing the apparent beheading of Alan Henning. He's the fourth Western captive killed by ISIS since August.
The core question, should governments pay or assist in paying ransom in exchange for our citizens, or should they refuse, as our government does, lest rewarding kidnapping begets more kidnappings? Other countries embrace a third way. France, Spain, Italy, and other European governments publicly deny paying ransoms, but they do. Others, like Denmark, facilitate payments from families of hostages. Not so the U.S. or the U.K.
The theory being that with such a rigid and flexible stance, the terrorists will realize there's nothing to be gained by holding an American hostage, and therefore they will either avoid taking a hostage or will let them go because they're not going to gain anything from it.
Gary Nesner is a former hostage negotiator for the FBI.
It may sound reasonable and logical, but it simply doesn't work that way. I think it's clear that Americans still remain very desirable targets for many terrorist groups.
While leading the FBI's crisis negotiation unit from 1990 to 2003, Nesner handled more than 120 overseas kidnapping cases.
The word negotiate, Bob, has come to mean capitulation and acquiescence. And negotiations is simply a dialogue. It's simply a channel of communication. And there are innumerable reasons why that works to our benefit.
Among them, intelligence gathered during the process. Another, forestalling a violent conclusion. A dialogue, Nesner says, at least suggests to hostage takers that there might be some eventual benefit, so they keep the hostage alive. He reflects on a case in which missionaries were kidnapped by the Colombian FARC group.
And the missionary organization said, we're going to tell these people in no uncertain terms that we will never negotiate with them. And the terrorists killed three hostages. You never want to slam the door shut like that.
Open communication also helps clarify the captors' ultimate goals, whether publicity, money, or something else.
I worked a case in Africa many years ago where they wanted money, but we ended up giving them office supplies and camping equipment, and that sufficed.
ISIS isn't in it for the paper clips and propane stoves, but point taken. Hostages are a commodity in a marketplace, a bizarre bazaar.
And one of the common mistakes that anyone makes, including people in government, is they hear an initial demand. We want $100 million. And they say, we're not going to pay $100 million. Well, in most of the developing world where these kidnappings occur, even terrorist ones, kidnap payouts range about 10% of what the initial demand was.
Like buying a pashmina in a bazaar, there's the starting price and then there's the transaction price.
Well, that's right. You've got to haggle it down. It's expected. It's cultural. We're not very good at that in the United States.
Nesner says that when he worked at the FBI in the 90s and early 2000s, the ransom question was met with greater flexibility. The government never paid, but the State Department did not stop families from paying.
If they determined to do it, we would help them do it safely and smartly. What happened, I think, is post 9/11, there began a slow tightening of the interpretation of what the FBI could do.
It got kind of complicated and confusing for us as families because we were hearing different things from different branches of the government.
Diane Foley is the mother of late journalist and ISIS hostage James Foley. While the family was fighting for his release, the FBI urged them to be in touch with James' captors. But the State Department warned of prosecution if they paid a ransom. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was threatening, creating anxiety and confusion now addressed by an interagency hostage task force called a fusion cell.
Since Jim's death, the hostage review that was done and the new formation of the hostage recovery fusion cell now has State Department co-located with FBI and intelligence. That in itself is a huge improvement.
The fusion cell is a sort of war room staffed by members of the Departments of Justice, Defense, State, Treasury, Intelligence, and the FBI. It's a fix for the turf wars and poor communication that have often muddled the government's response. The no U.S. concessions to terrorists rule hasn't changed, but families will not be prosecuted for paying ransoms. Diane Foley herself was deeply involved in the government's review and has become a hostage family champion, advocating passionately for a hard look at the policy the U.S. stands so firmly by. Mainly, the assumption that refusing to make concessions depresses the market for American hostages.
There was recently a report put out by West Point that actually showed that Americans are being captured at the same rate as other citizens around the world. So we need to make sure that our current policy does protect us, right?
Gary Nesner echoes that sentiment.
There is no data that I can find that would suggest, for example, that a gang of terrorists grabs an American and then all of a sudden has an epiphany and says, oh, we've grabbed an American by mistake, so we're not going to get any money, so let's let him go.
I really think we need to come together as Western allies. Jim was with 17 other Westerners, three of whom were Americans, but we had Italy, France, the United Kingdom, Germany, and yet each country handled it themselves. And if we had come together, you know, who knows? There might have been possibility of everyone being freed.
Perhaps, but the fundamental tension still remains between a family's wishes and the government's philosophy, between what we think is sound policy and what we'd do if it were us. Indeed, the fates of nearly two dozen ISIS hostages held in the same prison seem to reflect the different policies in the starkest way possible. The European hostages were released. Those from the UK and the US were killed. Gary Nesner.
I don't agree with European countries having paid large sums, and I don't think the U.S. government should ever pay a penny. However, there is a much lower expectation of what a family could pay versus a government. So we're starting out in a whole different bargaining position. Envision it being that daughter of yours, and somebody says, if you don't pay $100,000, she's dead. Well, you're going to come up with some money. It may not be $100,000, but you're going to negotiate and come up with some money. It's your family member. And that's the dilemma people get in. And I think often some government officials don't understand.
Diane Foley, grieving mother turned activist, has helped inject human emotion and perhaps common sense into the process. Like many victims of family tragedy, she's still trying to fill the unfillable void with meaning and purpose.
Jim would have wanted all American hostages to come home. He would have wanted families supported, and he definitely would have wanted conflict journalists, particularly the independent ones, to be safer so that they could do their work. So that is our work. I feel as long as we're still on Earth, it's my role and our challenge to continue to do our best to make it a better world. That's the only way as far as I'm concerned. We got to try, Bob. We got to keep trying.
Among Diane's efforts has been to help fund Hostage U.S., a new organization dedicated to assisting hostage families through their ordeals. Rachel Briggs, who runs Hostage U.S. and helped found its parent organization, Hostage U.K., more than a decade ago, was also dragged into her vocation by grim circumstance.
As a very young 19-year-old at university 20 years ago, my uncle was kidnapped in Colombia. We spent 7.5 months not knowing whether he was alive or dead, there never being enough information, the information being confusing, a sense that you have no agency over what's going on. It was really that formative experience that determined me that something needed to be done.
Briggs' uncle returned safely. Hostage U.S. has a, quote, policy of no policy when it comes to ransoms. Instead, it aims to fill a compassion gap, helping families with the nitty-gritty, from conveying traumatic information to children to providing financial advice if a breadwinner is held captive.
For many of our families, the most contact they've had with government is getting a parking ticket. And suddenly they find themselves in the middle of this awful drama, dealing with FBI, State Department, DOJ, private security companies. We're able to help them to make sense of what's going on, give them pointers about what questions to ask, how to hold those agencies to account, really how to do their jobs as families as well as they possibly can.
Is there a, top 10 list of the things that hostage families face that they simply don't anticipate as they're dragged into this process?
They might be, for example, asked for a DNA sample within the first few weeks. Well, a family's automatic reaction to that is he dead? Are you asking for this because he's dead and you're not telling me? We're able to give them reassurance that that's actually just a very routine thing to ask for early in the case so that it's on file and it's ready should it be needed. One of, I guess, the most common sources of anxiety for families is media interest. Some of them suddenly find the media camped on their doorstep, journalists threatening to break the story against their wishes. I guess the other thing is having to engage with very large bureaucracies. Picture the scene, you're the wife of a hostage and you have a minor car accident. You phone the car insurance company and their first question is, can I speak to the policyholder? Well, you can't because he's a hostage, but I can't tell you why you can't because I've been told by the government that I need to keep this secret. Families kind of find themselves paralyzed in those situations.
You are constantly immersed in other people's worst nightmares. I wonder what most appalls you about what those people go through.
I would say the thing that grinds down any family going through this situation is this constant sense of uncertainty. Day in, day out, you are hearing nothing, you are learning nothing, you have pretty much no control over the situation. I remember speaking to the elderly mother of a hostage who was going into work every day in her local hospital and was having to keep the secret that her son was being held overseas and answering questions. How is he? Yeah, he's doing great. He's still on his travels. The pressure that that puts on somebody is unimaginable. And of course, her colleagues only found out when they read in the newspapers about his brutal murder. I guess what we're able to do is be one of the few people in their lives that they can speak openly about what's going on.
Rachel Briggs is the director of Hostage US and Hostage UK. Deborah and Mark Tice are the parents of Austin Tice, a freelance American journalist who disappeared in Syria nearly 4 years ago. At age 30, Austin went abroad with the purest of intentions to report firsthand what befell the people there. He had little experience, but a lot of verve and nerve, venturing deeper into Syria than nearly any other Western journalist. Within a month, he was filing stories for McClatchy and The Washington Post, appearing on CBS and giving interviews to NPR.
From what I've seen, when the rebels fight, the civilians come out in the streets and leave them, you know, platters of food and pitchers of water to support them when they're fighting.
Then in August 2012, he vanished. 6 nightmarish weeks later, his family saw evidence of life, a video showing him being led blindfolded up a hillside by armed, masked men.
Oh, Jesus.
Since that video, the Tices have had no communication with Austin or his captors. But they have had what they call credible recent reports that Austin is still alive and that he isn't held either by ISIS or Syrian rebel groups. The Syrian regime denies any responsibility, but its network of militias have the means and the histories to be suspect. For its part, the U.S. government has told the Tices to be patient. Deborah Tice says that staying silent never made sense to them.
If your child goes missing in the mall, you don't go and whisper in a security guard's ear. The natural response is to start hollering your child's name, asking everyone in the mall if they've seen them, raising a ruckus.
With the help of Reporters Without Borders, the Tices have run full-page ads in major newspapers, rented billboards in their hometown of Houston, launched social media campaigns, given dozens of interviews. But despite their best efforts, they've found it next to impossible to reach the American public, even their own neighbors.
It always just floors us. You know, even now we'll get the question, well, are you guys going to go public?
That frustration was epitomized most recently at a rally at the White House organized by journalism students at Austin's alma mater, Georgetown University. It was well publicized. There was a lot of interest. It was a beautiful day, but
the attendance was small. It was small. It was great to see it, but compared to what we see in some other countries, I mean, in Lebanon, when someone goes missing, they burn tires on the highway. In 2015, I was in Paris for World Press Freedom Day, and there were thousands of people there. When one of their citizens is taken missing, they throw banners on their tallest buildings and say, we will not stand for our people being taken, and we will bring them home. I'm not really sure, Bob, why we can't get that kind of groundswell in America.
Is it hostage fatigue?
I think it's really about what are people invested in? What are they passionate about? And how the modern news cycle, you know, is constantly changing. You can't keep your message on top for long.
There was a very sympathetic piece about Austin and you in Texas Monthly. But at the end of it, there was this description of you as having become, I think it said, a full-time hostage family. And I wonder what percentage of that is the realistic notion that you can help secure Austin's release, and what percentage of it is just a coping mechanism?
There's no doubt that Deborah and I both feel strongest when we're taking action. On the other hand, we found out very early, you know, and this is an old cliche, you know, don't worry, the government's here, they're going to help you. That just wasn't the case. So we not only felt like we had to figure out what we could do, but that it was actually necessary.
And what happens every time the phone rings?
Well, we don't jump anymore, but we do answer it every time it rings in the middle of the night. And the last thing that both of us do before we hit the pillow is check all of our Google alerts, our Twitter feeds, search the internet for anything new. Deborah does way too much of that in the middle of the night.
It's not the middle of the night on the other side of the world.
There you go.
We are a hostage family. Austin has 6 siblings. And even though his youngest brother is 22, they have sorely missed their parents these last 3 years and 9 months. And to fill the gap that Mark, and especially me, the only job that I've ever had is to be the mom, they have really held it together for each other through college graduations and weddings, big life events, where it would have been so different if I had been fully present. And I do think they're quite tired of it.
Early on in his expedition, to people who asked him, what in the world are you up to? Austin wrote a Facebook post. I'm just going to read a portion of it. Our granddads stormed Normandy and Iwo Jima and defeated global fascism. Neil Armstrong flew to the moon in a glorified trash can, doing math on a clipboard as he went. Sometime between when our granddads licked the Nazis and when we started putting warnings on our coffee cups about the temperature of our beverage, America lost that pioneering spirit. We became a fat, weak, complacent, coddled, unambitious, and cowardly nation. So that's why I came here to Syria, and it's why I like being here now, right in the middle of a brutal and still uncertain civil war. This is a manifesto about a life with purpose.
You know, it's that fearless sense of calling that fills our history books with heroes.
Deborah and Mark Tice are the parents of Austin Tice, the freelance American journalist who disappeared in Syria in August 2012.
All the kidnapped reporters, living or dead, shared that fearless sense of calling to break the silence and to tell the truth. In the end, they're either ransomed or vanished or beheaded after condemning the West. Only John Cantley must break the silence again and again with words that have no relevance to truth. A mythical torture, right? When Prometheus stole fire from mankind, Zeus chained him to a rock where daily an eagle ate his liver, which was nightly regenerated. He was kept alive, like Cantley. Of course, Prometheus eventually was freed by Hercules. We haven't yet gotten to the end of Cantley's story.
This week's show was produced almost entirely by Meera Sharma.
I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.